This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is our Friday Week in Review with stories this week that ask, are our policies meeting the moment? Whether it's a multi-million dollar lottery to get more people vaccinated.
We're hopeful that this giveaway will give another reason, opportunity for people to choose to get vaccinated here in the Commonwealth over the next couple of months.
The region's response to predictions of up to 40 inches of sea level rise by 2070.
And at some point, maybe before the end of the century, rising tide mean that we won't be able to protect the subway system from flooding twice a day at high tide.
Or the recognition of Juneteenth as an official holiday while we grapple with our nation's history on race.
When President Lincoln said we were free, it wasn't actually really true for everybody. So Juneteenth is a reminder that it's not just the moments at which the people at the top are free, but not until everybody is free are we really free.
We heard there Governor Charlie Baker announcing Vax Millions, Julie Wormser of the Mystic River Watershed Association on the vulnerability of the MBTA, and Reverend Mariama White Hammond of the New Roots AME Church on the significance of Juneteenth. So again, are we going far enough on the big issues of our time? Join our panelists to talk about it today, starting with your reactions to the Commonwealth's new vaccine lottery initiative. What do you think of Vax Millions? The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now are panelists Michael Curry, President and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors, and Jennifer Braceras, Political Analyst, Lawyer, and Director of the Independent Women's Law Center. Michael, welcome back.
Hey, Tiziana, glad to be back.
Jennifer, welcome back to you, too.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, Jennifer, I'm going to start with you. Vaccine incentive via lottery, $10 million at play. Is it a good idea?
I don't love it. I mean, I think people should want to get vaccinated. I think the science supports vaccination. I don't know why we're spending money to get people to be vaccinated. People should get vaccinated. I don't really approve of paying them off to do so.
So I'm going to pick up that thread, and Michael, I'm actually going to play some sound from you from a segment you were in, but I'm going to play Dr. Ashish Jha, who's the dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. We had a conversation a couple of weeks ago about, you know, just in general, are vaccine incentives a good idea? And he kind of sounds some of what Jennifer just said. Here he is.
These incentives, they have marginal effects, but they should not be confused for the real effect that comes from working with people who understand communities where vaccine levels are low. And what I worry about, again, I've been pretty pro, you know, vaccine incentives, but what I worry about is that people will see that as a shortcut to our way home, and it's not.
Is shortcuts even the right attempt? Should we be trying to make shortcuts, Michael, or does that just cost us in the long run?
Yeah, well, first, I was on that segment with Dr. Jha, and, you know, I'm such a huge fan of him that it seemed like we were disagreeing slightly, and I never want to disagree with Dr. Jha or Fauci or anyone else who I think have been on the front lines of really responding to this pandemic. But I think ultimately, you know, just taking a pause that we have 4 million Massachusetts residents vaccinated and that we have a remaining population that are hesitant, that are unsure, that don't have the information on the efficacy and science that they need. And I think the best public health approach to reaching them is information and engagement, whether that's the one-on-one that we're seeing happening in the Cape, particularly community health centers are going door to door, or the buses that we're seeing in Western Mass that are actually traveling in the communities, or even the train option here in Massachusetts that the governor's put in place. It can seem gimmicky to do these lotteries and scholarships, but ultimately, you know, I'd say let's use every tool in the tool belt, but we can't overly rely on these incentives that, quite frankly, may bring you in for a shot, but may not bring you back for a booster.
I agree with Michael that education is the best way to increase vaccinations. And I guess my problem with the lottery is it's not going to convince people who have strong objections to vaccines from getting the vaccine. I mean, if you can be convinced by money to go and get a vaccine, then you didn't really have strong, you know, reasons for not getting it in the first place.
Let's go to the phones here then. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Are you going to enter the lottery? Will it make any difference to you or someone you love in choosing to get vaccinated? We've got Devin on the line from Natick. Devin, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me on today. So I was listening to your program there, and personally, I just wanted to call in and say that I think it's a little ridiculous that in America in 2021, we have to bribe people to get a vaccine that people in other parts of the world would gladly take for free. That's all. I just think it's a little ridiculous that we're actually bribing people to take a vaccine that will help the world.
Devin, well, thanks for that. And just Jennifer, just say that again, because I was talking over you a little bit.
Oh, I just said, well said. The caller put it nicely.
Okay, and to you, Michael, because I know you were going to respond too.
It's interesting, although I'm not a huge fan of these incentives, and I understand why Governor Baker, Secretary Sutter's administration pursued it, because states like California, Ohio, West Virginia, New Jersey, quite frankly, in many cases, some of those states haven't deployed vaccines as well as we have, relatively. They've seen some benefit from this. I understand the motivation. The motivation is that not all of citizens agree with him, your caller, and some of them just don't see their connection to this overall public health campaign. They don't see the urgency of the moment. They don't necessarily feel like they're at risk. And this is sort of an incentive to draw people in to say, hey, in order for us to reach herd immunity, 70%, whatever that number ultimately is, we need to pull people in with, as we used to say in communities of color, hook or crook, right? Anything that you can use to pull people in. But, you know, I still think it's not the best approach, though I think it's shown some benefit in other places.
And one of our producers is noting to me that Governor Baker did speak extensively with Ohio Governor Mike DeWine. They did have success with their lottery there. I want to play for the two of you a little bit of sound. This is Governor Baker speaking in Springfield this week. Springfield, the county it's in, Hampden County, has one of the lowest vaccination rates in the state. Here he is.
And I do hope that the Vax-a-Million program encourages some of those younger folks who probably aren't that worried about COVID themselves. Their parents are vaccinated, their grandparents are vaccinated, the older folks they know are vaccinated. I hope that's the sort of thing that encourages them to get vaccinated. But we're not going to stop.
So stepping away from Vax-a-Millions for a minute, just to this idea of who is and isn't worried. Michael, you pointed out we've got more than 4 million people vaccinated. You know, this week we've got the lowest positivity rate in testing since basically we started tracking. People aren't worried. You know, the pandemic feels far away. We are feeling increasingly safe. How do we get over that hurdle itself? Just that it's safe, I don't have to be the next one, because things just aren't that bad right now. Jennifer, how do we think about that?
Well, I mean, you might as well get vaccinated, even if the risks are lower and the infection rates are dropping. I mean, I actually have a friend who was putting off getting vaccinated for that reason, saying, well, everybody else is going to be vaccinated and there's going to be herd immunity. And, you know, my chances of getting it will be very low. And then this person got it. And the person's, and he got it badly, and he wasn't hospitalized, but he was very sick. And he said to me afterwards, I wish I could go back and take back what I said and tell people that it actually really stinks to get it, even if you aren't hospitalized and don't have lifelong complications. And you should get vaccinated. You should just get vaccinated.
So I want to put that question out to listeners, especially, you know, Jennifer's got a story there. We know Dr. Fauci told Morning Edition on National Public Radio this week, you know, with the Delta variant, if you are not vaccinated, you are not safe from the Delta variant. If you are not vaccinated, will you be? And what would help you make that decision? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mike, I'm going to turn to you now. You know, since we've started talking about vaccines, we've started to talk about concerns around vaccination disparities. They are high. They are similar to predictions about which populations would be less vaccinated. According to the Boston Globe, 47% of Black residents in Massachusetts, 45% of Hispanic residents, 42% of Native American residents have had at least one dose, whereas overall we have 65% of people vaccinated with at least one dose. So what is the right next step? And in a minute, we'll get to the rural versus urban. There are some other splits as well. But what is the right next step? And what other creative ways does the Commonwealth need to take to protect everyone and to partner with everyone to get them protected?
Yeah, I think, you know, first to the prior conversation around why some people are hesitant and the issue of why, the urgency of why we need them to, I always point people back to history. When the Spanish flu hit in 1918, and it went through December 1920, it infected over 500 million people worldwide, 675,000 deaths in the U.S., 5 million worldwide. And what people may not know is it hit in spring of 1918. It came back more deadly by the fall. So we're not done with this disease, potentially. And folks need to realize, whether it's the Delta variant or several other variants in the future, they need to be protected against those, and we need to be vigilant. That being said, the equity challenge is no surprise. As you and I, Tiziana, have talked about this many times, there's a historical taint of race in our healthcare system that people just don't trust our healthcare system. There's a lived experiences by uncles and aunts of mine and cousins and friends and family, and research reveals that Black and brown folks don't receive the same care in our healthcare system, even today, that people have preconceived notions or racial bias that plays out when they are interacting with our healthcare system. And for many of those reasons, in addition to access issues, that while we're at 57-60% vaccinated and less in communities of color, that's a challenge we need to solve. And I hope we don't just solve for the moment, we solve for the underlying systemic issues that make people not be able to get the care that they need when they need it.
I want to add two things. One about equity and one about vaccine hesitancy generally. On the equity point, I cannot stress enough how important accessibility is. And frankly, in poorer communities where people are just trying to get through the day and get to work and put food on the table, it is really important that these vaccines, that it's easy for people to get them and take them. And if that means, you know, setting up a neighborhood program or going door to door or whatever it takes, accessibility and ease of access is really important in those communities that are overwhelmed by a lot of other things and might not have the time, you know, to take out, to, you know, go and get it otherwise. So I think that's an important piece of the equity problem. On vaccine hesitancy generally, I don't want to underestimate the role that the media has played in scaring people. And when I say that, what I'm referring to is the past X number of years, we've had endless stories on the evils of Big Pharma. And the bottom line is Big Pharma saved humanity here, okay? But we have a lot of people who are afraid of Big Pharma, who think that Big Pharma doesn't have their interests at heart. And that is in part because of the way we have spun other stories about the pharmaceutical industry for many, many years. And it's having a negative repercussion now.
Michael, what do you think about that?
Yeah, there's so much to unpack with that. And, you know, I think ultimately, as I was on a panel discussion with MassBio, and I've been on some national conversations, and an African-American woman who's the head of diversity for one of the pharmaceutical industries, she said, people don't trust us because we haven't been trustworthy. Which I thought was a revelation coming from a person who's now representing one of the major pharmaceutical countries in the world. Of course they save lives. Of course they come up with groundbreaking medicines that can save lives. But they've also had a dark side in terms of some decisions. You can look at Africa. You can look at certain communities that have been used for experimentation or for clinical trials in a way that was not fully within ethical boundaries in terms of consent. So I think we can have an honest conversation, and it's not either black or white, it's somewhere in between. And that whether it's our hospitals, our community providers, or our health system, our health plans writ large, we have a story to tell that's not all rosy, that we've failed in some cases. So I'm looking forward to an honest conversation. And I wouldn't disagree with Jennifer that there's the media has portrayed the negative, but quite frankly, we don't even know all of the truths about the negative, but we do need to lift up in this moment where they've come together to save lives in COVID-19.
I just think we have to stop with the conspiracy theories. I mean, obviously mistakes have been made by, you know, a lot of corporations, and I'm all for exposing them. But the bottom line is that you know, in 2021, the medical community and the pharmaceutical community are out there, well-intentioned, trying to save lives, trying to help people, and we have to stop scaring people away from wanting to access, you know, the good intentions of others.
So I'm hearing a both and on this, recognizing there is a history of medical maltreatment of vulnerable populations in the United States, and also recognizing that the corporate development of vaccines was really important. I also think we want to recognize the $18 billion in funding for development that came from the U.S. government through Operation Warp Speed. I mean, one way possibly to look at this is history is real, and there was some mighty collaboration, you know, at this point. We're going to go to a break here in a second. We have some calls, so what I'm going to do is just take a couple of calls together, and then we'll go to a break. We've got Isaac on the line in Marblehead. Isaac, go ahead.
So I just lost somebody yesterday in Ireland. We think it's the Delta variant, and our week blew apart. I think the time for, let's say, discussing the pros and cons of getting or not getting vaccinated is over. Get vaccinated.
The Delta variant is
coming as another surge. And my wife's back home. Luckily, she hopped on a plane Monday night and got home and is helping with the family. But his son is still in hospital with COVID, so this is like a double whammy. And, you know, he was half vaccinated. The father was actually fully vaccinated. And I've had a guy in my team at work that both his parents were fully vaccinated 2 months ago, and they still got the Delta variant in India. Now, the good news is that if you do get the Pfizer vaccine, you stand a better chance of surviving the Delta variant if you've been vaccinated. I'm not sure what your chances are if you get it and you get the severe type and you're not vaccinated. I imagine they're probably zero to none. So,
thank you, Isaac. I'm going to take it back from you there to give some data. And I am sorry for your loss. Some things that we know right now in the Commonwealth, breakthrough cases for those who have been vaccinated of any kind of COVID-19 are about 1 in 1,000. We know, again, Dr. Fauci earlier this week said that we are seeing high efficacy rates of our vaccines in the United States against the Delta variant, but very big concern about the rapid spread. It is a more aggressive form, if aggressive is the right word, spreads more easily, can make people sicker of the Delta variant in the United States. It is also not yet the dominant variant in the United States, although its rate of growth here in the country is fast. All right, one more call here from Ernesto, and then we'll go to break. Ernesto in the South End, go ahead.
Hi, I just want to suggest that the governor of Massachusetts stop, have a deadline for free vaccines, like, let's say, the end of July. And then if you're not vaccinated by the end of July, then you'll have to pay for it because the government is giving it for free and people do not appreciate it. So if you stop the free vaccine after the end of July, then people might vaccinate themselves because they do not want to pay for the vaccine. And that's my comment.
Thanks for that call. And Ernesto, thinking about behavioral economics there, and we've had a number of conversations on Radio Boston and other WBUR shows about the role of behavioral economics and figuring out what's going to work. Still with us, Jennifer Braceras, political analyst, lawyer, and director of the Independent Women's Law Center, and Michael Curry, president and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. We're talking this hour about stories this week that raise the question of whether our policies are meeting the moment. And next, we want to talk about sea level rise. So to you listeners, is your city or town sufficiently preparing for rising sea levels, other climate impacts? Are you worried about the T and its ability to keep up with sea level rise? What do you want to see your city or town do about climate and infrastructure? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. So So we did a WBUR series on rising sea levels this week, what it could mean for everything from the seaport to the Blue Line. In general, Jennifer Braceras, can the region meet the moment with the threats that rising sea level poses?
Well, I'm not an environmental engineer, so I can't fully answer that question. But what I can say is we absolutely should be attempting to put in place mitigation measures. In fact, I've been arguing for that for many years, that the focus when it comes to climate change should be on environmental mitigation and protecting our environment and our communities, rather than trying to halt something that we can't necessarily be effective in halting, which is some degree of inevitable climate change. I mean, you know, if the city of Boston prohibits something or the state of Massachusetts prohibits something, that's not necessarily going to affect global climate change when, you know, India and other developing nations are continuing to pollute the environment. So the best thing we can do, the best use of our resources, is in mitigation.
All right. So, Jennifer, they're focusing on mitigation. Michael Curry, I want to play some sound for you from Julie Wormser, who's the deputy director at the Mystic River Watershed Association.
When the Blue Line was first built, the probability was zero that it would be knocked out by high tide. And at some point, maybe before the end of the century, rising tide mean that we won't be able to protect the subway system from flooding twice a day at high tide.
So mitigation of an infrastructure, an older infrastructure that is very vulnerable. I mean, it's underground. What's your response to both Julie Wormser and Jennifer just there about the focus on mitigation? What does that mean we have to do, and do we have the resources to do it?
Yeah, so, you know, we have a lot to tackle, especially as we're getting ready, as we're debating in Congress right now an infrastructure bill, right? So there's a lot to think about when it comes to roads, bridges, but quite frankly, our transportation system, which is outdated and underdeveloped and resourced as well. You know, this is not a new conversation. I've spent probably most of my adult life doing policy work, sitting in legislative hearings around emergency preparedness. Floods was a part of that conversation on many levels in many years. And people have been talking about flood mapping and stormwater capture, crisis management, flood defenses, hazard-resistant infrastructure, community engagement, long-term planning, tree planting, right? Those are all common conversation, landslide risk mapping. And how do you engage communities that are most vulnerable? I use the example of New Orleans with Katrina, that when there is one of these floods and disasters, it will most likely impact those that are closest to the pain, using Ayanna's Presley, Congressman Presley's phrase, that those people in Dorchester and Roxbury and Mattapan and parts of the city and parts of the state and region that are most vulnerable. So we have to stop acting like this is an epiphany we had in these conversations. Flood is a real possibility based on what the data that you and the station has really been focusing in on this week. We have to do what we know how to do, which is plan, which is strategize, which is incorporate voices from the community in this work. And then we can deal with the problem. But if we keep doing this episodic and we do this handoff between mayors and governors, where the next governor may not take it as seriously, or maybe it's not resourced as well in terms of the research, we need to make this a priority, no matter who's in elected office, and make sure that we're prepared. Just like we should have been prepared for a pandemic, we need to be prepared for this inevitability.
So as we're talking, in the back of my mind, I'm hearing listeners who are going to want to raise the global issues, are going to want to raise whether or not the United States is doing everything it can in the larger system. You know, our return to the Paris Climate Accords, our relationship with other countries, whether we're polluting our fair share. I want to acknowledge all of that. I know that's in listeners' minds, but we're having a pretty substantive conversation locally. We're Radio Boston here, and we're talking about local infrastructure. I want to stay there to both Jennifer's and Michael's points, and I want to play a moment from my interview this week with MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak. I asked him about, well, you'll hear my question and you'll hear his answer. Let's just listen. Do you think there's any part of our T infrastructure that eventually becomes non-viable given sea level rise and the overall impacts of climate change?
I think we're going to be challenged in some places, but I think, I mean, it's a broader challenge for the Metro Boston region. I don't see any place where the T would unilaterally say some piece of the system would be non-viable.
Now, I focus on that and the pause, right? The long pause after the question, not as a gotcha moment, but in this larger sense of how challenging this is. Whether or not our institutions have the vision we need right now and are ready, and whether or not we can collaborate effectively regionally on these big systems issues. I invite your reactions. Jennifer.
Well, I do think Michael's right that we've been having these conversations for a long time. We need to plan, and we need to prepare for it in a way that perhaps we didn't prepare for this pandemic. What's interesting is that there's bipartisan support for this. There's bipartisan support for infrastructure renewal and for environmental mitigation policies. Our leaders need to take that challenge and they need to work with this bipartisan consensus. And really it's a question of resources. It's not a question of political will, because I do think there's support across party lines for this.
And Michael Curry, before we go on to our next subject, do we have time for that work?
Yeah, I think we do. I'm going to channel my very good friend, former general manager of the T here, Beverly Scott. She would say, you bet your patootie we're in for some trouble if we don't plan for it. And those will appreciate that if they remember Beverly Scott. And the reality is we've seen floods in our train systems when there have been storms, weather conditions. We know that our system is, I believe, the oldest in the country. And we need those kind of investments. We can't do it alone. We require federal dollars to help us get there. That's why I think Mayor Janey, former Mayor Walsh, now Secretary Walsh, need to be in the room advocating for these resources for Massachusetts, along with our congressional delegation, to make sure that the inevitability we can blunt the impact of what is likely to happen with rising sea levels and storms that may cost lives or ruin this city's infrastructure.
And just to your point, Boston Subway was the first in the U.S., America's first subway. There's a lot more we're going to have to follow on this. We could keep talking about this, but there is one more subject I want to get in together. Again, sort of this at the intersection of the moment we're in and the policy steps we're taking and how those things match up. And that is the observance of Juneteenth. Yesterday, President Biden signed it as a federal holiday. Over the next couple of days, depending on which municipality and here in the Commonwealth, for the first time we are observing Juneteenth. We had a really thoughtful conversation with Professor Kelly Carter Jackson and Reverend Mariama White Hammond about the celebration of Juneteenth yesterday. Let's just open up this part of the conversation by listening to a little from Kelly Carter Jackson, who is an associate professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley, on how she hopes people who may be celebrating Juneteenth for the first time will do it.
I really want this to be something for them that is fun and enjoyable, and where they too have a history of this. They acknowledge this as part of their history, but they also see the wonderful ways that we can celebrate what it means to be Black in this country, and how even though racism is terrible, Blackness is not.
And listeners, are you celebrating Juneteenth, either for your first time or for the manyth time? Is your community doing it? What do those celebrations look like? And how to stand at an intersection of joy and pain in this observance? 1-800-423-8255 is the number, 1-800-423-TALK. So Michael, Jennifer, just rapid fire, are your communities observing Juneteenth in official ways? Michael?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been calling for this for many years. The reality is if you're American and you've been celebrating 1776 as Independence Day, millions of Africans were not independent. Millions of African-Americans were not independent and free. And quite frankly, it's been a misrepresentation. So maybe it should be 1776, 1863, or 1865, or 1963, or 1964, right? We can challenge history. I think I'll end it on this. One of my favorite proverbs is, hunters will cease being heroes when lions have historians. Hunters will cease being heroes when lions have historians. And I'm thankful that we now have historians for Lions to tell the truth about American history.
Jennifer, how important is it that the Commonwealth mark this day?
I think it's super important, and I think it's a great compliment to the 4th of July observance. I disagree with Michael that 1776 isn't our country's true birthday or a true celebration of freedom. It absolutely is a celebration of political freedom and of Enlightenment principles that had never before been...
For white Americans.
No, it's a celebration of Enlightenment principles that had never before been observed in the form of a government. And it was an aspirational document, the Declaration of Independence, one we're still striving to live up to today. I love the 4th of July. I love the idea of Juneteenth too. I want my kids to learn more about it. It's an important part of our history. One thing I think is interesting about it is, you know, unlike holidays that celebrate individual people, a holiday that celebrates an aspect of our shared history, I think is a little less fraught, because when you celebrate an individual, and I'm all for celebrating Columbus Day and Washington's birthday and Martin Luther King Day, but when you celebrate a human being, all human beings are flawed. All human beings are imperfect. And you open yourself up to applying the standards of today to the time in which that individual lived. And so some people will criticize. They'll criticize the person and then therefore criticize the holiday. But when you celebrate the 4th of July, or when you celebrate Juneteenth, you're celebrating a moment in time. You're celebrating progress towards where we are now. You're celebrating how far we've come. And so I think it's almost a better way for a nation to celebrate. Now, that, you know, that said, we need heroes. We do. But the celebration of an event is something that I think is truly special.
And just so to, Jennifer, to make sure we're agreeing,
yes, Michael,
Jennifer and I, because I was saying that it's not just 1776. It could also be 1863 with the Emancipation Proclamation, or 1865 when Gordon Granger announced in Texas that those former slaves, they still thought they were slaves, were free. So I think we can go back and recalibrate our history to understand that there's more than one Independence Day. And particularly for those millions of African Americans, those 4 million African people of African descent, who were liberated because of the end of slavery.
They're just different milestones. I mean, one is the birth of a nation, and one is the celebration of emancipation for many people, and they're both worth celebrating.
So just a couple things. First, listeners, just call in. Add your thoughts to this. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to talk about this for a few more minutes. If you want to share your thoughts, call. I want to play a moment. Listen, A, we do best on this show when I have the two of you, when I let you talk to each other. That's when I learn the most. But I do want to play something I learned, something that changed how I was thinking, from a caller from yesterday. This is Jack from Waltham, and he's talking about how he thinks about that moment of announcement in Texas in 1865.
And I think what is important is for us to take our minds back to that date in 1865. And I would surmise that the majority of slaves knew they were free, but the slave masters had not acknowledged it. They had tried to keep it from us. And I would think of it as a time when actually the Emancipation Proclamation began to be enforced and acknowledged in Texas. The majority of slaves knew they were free, but their masters wouldn't let them go.
So I'm going to go to Michael first, but I want to make a point to each of you out of that, and then I'll go to Michael. Michael, my point to you, that was yet another reframing of the moment, and one that has not been in the dominant narrative that I've been learning as I've been learning about Juneteenth. And Jennifer, I think then it sets in relief the question about whether it's celebrating progress or acknowledging that progress had to be forced. Those were the two things that the call made me think about. So Michael, let me invite you to react first.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much context for this that I hope people embrace this holiday, and credit to the Biden administration that we finally reached a point. And I think the advocates, because quite frankly, whether it's Ben Haith here in Boston, who was a proponent of Juneteenth, or the many advocates across the country, particularly those in Texas, that we acknowledge that 2.5 years after Emancipation Proclamation, those Black folks in Texas found out they were free. I want people to understand in this moment of self-reflection, of historical reflection, that they still weren't free after 1865, because you had Black codes. They couldn't take advantage of the Homestead Act, the Southern Homestead Act, which repositioned Americans, particularly white Americans. That home, that the Black codes and Jim Crow would lock those former slaves out of opportunities for at least generations to come. So I think this is a jump off to really have a conversation, but also to celebrate that 4 million people were officially liberated is a part of American history that I hope is not just about Black folks. If you're a white person and you believe in just justice and liberty, that you are attached to that June 19th date, because that means something to you. A threat to justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. You have to absorb that quote from Dr. King, because that's real on this holiday.
Jennifer.
Well, look, I think we don't study enough history in this country. And sadly, in the town in which I live, and I would probably guess many others, the U.S. history curriculum doesn't cover the Civil War. They go from the founding to westward expansion, and then they jump to the Gilded Age. I mean, it's appalling. And if Juneteenth is a way to get Americans to sit back and read more about our history, it's a fabulous thing. People have to learn about it. I mean, so many people don't realize that the Emancipation Proclamation didn't even apply to all the slaves. It only applied to slaves in the part of the country that was in active rebellion. It didn't apply to slaves in states that hadn't seceded from the Union. So it wasn't a completely liberating document. It was a tool of war. And, you know, that's another interesting aspect that we should discuss, but we don't discuss it enough because it's not taught. And I hope that Juneteenth will become a vehicle for teaching the history, not only of slavery and of the Civil War, but, you know, of that whole time period generally, which is lost in our curricula.
Okay, as we prepare to wrap up, I'm going to just bring us one more piece of sound from yesterday. This is Reverend Mariama White Hammond on how our histories and holidays get taught, kind of building on you guys. Go ahead.
I think part of the reason that happened with Pride is because we've forgotten the story of Stonewall. A uprising, a action of police brutality, predominantly against Black trans women. And because that story has been missing from the conversation, it has just turned into a celebration. And I think the importance of Juneteenth is making sure that we tell our children, that we all tell the story of why Juneteenth exists.
That in response to a conversation about as it goes mainstream, will it somehow lose an important piece of what we can learn from history, Pride Month, and the criticisms of the sort of corporatization of Pride being the comparison there. All right, I didn't time that perfectly because I was going to come back to the two of you. We are running a touch short, so let's just do lightning round. Last thought going into the weekend, Michael Curry.
Yeah, I think it's great to have us reflecting on history. I'm excited that we're having this, but as Jennifer just pointed out, there's so much untapped history. Credit to our historians who've been really lifting up this moment of June 19th, 1865 for decades. The rest of us are just catching up.
And last lightning round comment to you, Jennifer.
Well, I think a great way to celebrate Juneteenth for all of us would be to reread the Emancipation Proclamation and to reread, you know, some of the stories from that era and think about what it achieved, what it didn't achieve, what it left unsolved, and, you know, think about how we can not only celebrate the Emancipation Proclamation, but you know, honor the legacy going forward.
All right, Jennifer Braceras of the Independent Women's Law Center, Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, thanks to both of you for reviewing the week.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
As we head into the weekend, we're going to go out today on sports. The winds of controversy have been swirling ferociously around the world of Major League Baseball this week, including buffeting pitchers for the Boston Red Sox. At the heart of it, what is the difference between cheating and just trying really hard to win?
Getting caught.
Getting caught. Yeah. So let's talk about that, because that's kind of what it's starting to look like, Chris. And I think we all recognize that question. This is obviously, we're checking the score. Obviously, this is Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Tiziana.
All right, so this is a universal story made specific in the MLB, and this specific is about sticky baseballs and pitchers, right?
Yeah, this is fascinating. So this all stems basically from a Sports Illustrated article that came out about 2 weeks ago that really kind of detailed the level to which some of these pitchers are applying this goop or sticky substances to the ball. And there were tales of guys going through airport security, getting flagged for having quote-unquote explosive material on their fingers just from having rubbed the balls up, balls going into the dugout and guys kind of like sticking them to their hands and trying to get them to fall off, and they would just stick. So it became so blatant, basically, that baseball was like, okay, we have to do something about this.
So, of course, now you've got the phrase goop, there it is, stuck in my head.
That's right.
For the rest of the day. And in fact, this is not actually new. Pitchers have been using stuff, substances on baseballs for a long time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Doctoring baseballs goes back to basically the beginning of the sport, and there's two ways to do it. You can apply a substance, or you can kind of scuff up the ball, and that's different. We're going to call that doctoring the ball. Really, we're talking about the substance-based stuff, and even this has been in the public conscious for decades. I got to take advantage of this and play a little cut here. This is from the 1989 hit movie Major League. Eddie Harris is a pitcher talking about the measures to which he goes to basically make the ball move when he's pitching.
Of course, if the umps are watching me close, I just rub a little jalapeno inside my nose, get it running, and if I need to load the ball up a little, just wipe my nose.
You put snot on the ball?
I haven't got an arm like yours. I got to put anything on it I can find.
So,
okay, so wait.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you for elevating the discourse here.
Always here to bring the class. I consider that my role here on Radio Boston. No, but it's actually not that far off. The first version we know of this was the spitball. I think probably a lot of folks have heard of the spitball. We don't really know who was the first person to throw one. There's kind of conflicting reports, but it was sometime mid to late 19th century. So this has been around a long time. Ed Walsh was the first pitcher to really kind of master the spitball and be a spitball pitcher. He dominated the league from 1906 to 1912 and basically made other people kind of want to try to pick this up. Ty Cobb actually wrote about baseball banning these freak pitches eventually, which they did. Called it owners selling out to the home run, which is echoing some themes that we've heard in recent years, which I think is interesting. But I just love this little fact here. We're talking sports on NPR, so I can go deep into the history of the spitball, I feel like. You geeked out on sewers earlier this week. Let's geek out on spitballs.
Let's geek out on the spitball.
So 1919 to 1920 season, they banned the spitball from baseball. But they allowed teams to pick two guys on their roster that could keep throwing spitballs that year. And then the following year, it was banned completely, but 17 spitball pitchers were basically grandfathered in and could keep throwing it. Now, obviously, guys have thrown it illegally plenty since then and have really gotten creative with how they goop up the ball.
Okay, so you've just underscored, though, and again, you know, anyone who's ever taken a test or competed in a sport or any other kind of competition can identify with when the rules seem random and randomly enforced. So what is going on today when we know that spitballs have been around since before Ty Cobb?
Yeah, basically it just got so bad that, like I said, this article came out kind of talking about it, but the numbers were really, really striking. So in 2016, there were more than 3,000 more hits than strikeouts across the league for the season, right? 2 years later, 2018, strikeouts had just barely overtaken hits. And then this year, we were on pace for more than 5,000 more strikeouts than hits. So you have a complete reversal of hits and strikeouts. So basically, batters are striking out left and right. The league average was plummeting. Guys just couldn't hit the ball. And you've had players talking about this for the last couple of years, saying basically, look, they're not enforcing these rules, so we're putting this really sticky, adhesive stuff on there. We're basically gluing the ball to our hand. And what that does is it allows them to generate incredible amounts of friction when they throw the ball. They can increase what they call spin rate. We're getting into baseball analytics a little bit. But the higher spin rate you have, the more the ball is spinning when you pitch it, the more it's going to move. And therefore, the harder it is for the batter to hit. And so the spin rate. Yeah, so go ahead.
Well, so, one, how is that not just cheating?
Well, because baseball kind of has this unwritten thing where they look the other way on stuff. Go back to the steroid era, right? Everybody knew guys across the league were taking steroids, and it got to the point where if you weren't taking steroids, you were putting yourself at a competitive disadvantage based on the way baseball was operating. And essentially, that's what happened here. You had guys say, look, everybody is doing this across the league. They're using this stuff called Spider Tack, which is made for the World's Strongest Man competitions, where they lift those huge boulders, like glue these boulders to your hand. So they're essentially gluing the ball to their hand, and it just got so out of hand that baseball felt they had a PR nightmare on their hands.
Okay, so let's walk to Fenway Park for a second. Tell me how this is, isn't, we don't know, affecting the Red Sox.
Well, it's interesting. So it's too soon. Baseball is a marathon, not a sprint, as folks in the game always say. So I think we don't have enough sample size to know, since baseball said they're going to crack down on this, what it looks like. But so far, not great. Red Sox pitchers have been getting shelled in the week or so since baseball announced this change, which takes effect on Monday officially. I want to play a little bit of Garrett Richards, who spoke to the media on Wednesday after he got shelled. And he had been pitching well all season, but then just absolutely got rocked. And you can hear the frustration in his voice when he's asked, what is this going to do to the game of baseball?
I think time will tell. I think if you just watch baseball across the league, you're going to see some interesting things. You know, be prepared for 4-hour long games and some interesting things. I don't know. I'm just grateful that I got this far into my career before we're at this point.
That last line is so striking to me. He's a veteran who's been around the league for a while, and he's just basically so grateful he didn't have to deal with this rule change as a young up-and-coming pitcher, because it's making it that much more difficult to hold the ball.
Okay, last minute or so. Of course, what I'm focused on is 4-hour games. I love baseball, but I don't want to watch for 4 hours. So what are the new rules, and what's it going to mean?
It's just basically that umps can check pitchers, their bodies, their uniforms, their gloves, their hats, anywhere they might hide a foreign substance. And if they find anything, even sunscreen, they can eject you immediately, and you're suspended for 10 games with pay. So it's not a huge impact for the player, but it's going to be really interesting to see how they enforce it, how often they eject guys. Are they taking up these suspensions? And what is that going to mean for how pitchers approach the game? Because they've really, all of these pitchers who are complaining are saying, look, I used to hold the ball like an egg. Now I have to grip it as tight as I possibly can. And you've had a couple of guys already with pretty significant injuries say, I got injured because I had to squeeze the ball tighter than I've had to ever had to squeeze it. And I can't believe they've made this change in the middle of a season.
Okay, lightning round, Chris. Couple of sentences, predictions.
Well, I think you're going to see offense up, and we've already seen that on some level. I think that's great. We've talked about baseball being hurt by these analytics, that it's been all strikeouts or home runs. I think you're going to see hitters putting a lot more balls in play. You're going to see more runs scored, which is exciting. I think it's going to make for a more exciting product. And I'd say to the pitchers, tough luck. You got to follow the rules. Big deal. It's the same across the board. Everybody plays by the same rules. Suck it up and get it done.
We'll have to have pitchers call in and talk to you next time. That's Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, thanks.
Thanks, you. Thank you, Tiziana.
All right, folks, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.